Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com reporting today via globalresearch.ca on the Kuala Lumpur initiative to criminalize war. For those who have not seen my recent report on this subject, I would suggest that you check it out. It is called War is a Crime, and it presents the proceedings of a conference that took place in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia just a few weeks ago. And I was in attendance at that conference. It was a 20th anniversary commemoration of the signing of the Kuala Lumpur Initiative to Criminalize War, and all of the background and meaning and explanation of that initiative is provided in that aforementioned report, so I will put that in the show notes so that you can go and check it out if you have not yet done so, along with my interview with former Malaysian Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, the person who spearheaded, launched, and helped to sign that initial declaration. Long story short, that declaration was a bold and obviously aspirational, but very important and very simple idea. Simply the idea that aggressive war is a crime in and of itself and deserves to be prosecuted as such. Now, again, that's an interesting concept, and you can see my report on that anniversary commemoration that I attended so that you can find out more about that idea, where it came from, how it unfolded, and where it's going. But as part of those proceedings, Professor Michelle Chossadovsky, who was one of the original signers of that original declaration back in 2005, was, of course, invited to attend that event, but was unable to. So I attended in his stead. But I was able to record a conversation with Professor Chossadovsky, his reflections and ruminations on the meaning of that 20th anniversary of that initiative. What is that initiative? Why is it important? What does it say that we have made, if not little progress, perhaps even the antithesis of progress towards that ideal of criminalizing war? And Professor Chossadovsky has some very interesting things to say about that, along the lines of, well, we have not made progress on criminalizing war, but we have made progress on criminalizing politics, criminalizing justice, criminalizing economics. What does he mean by those statements? I think it's a fascinating and interesting idea, so I trust that you will find a lot of food for thought in this presentation. So without further ado, I will present the presentation that Professor Chossadovsky recorded for that Kuala Lumpur commemoration, and I will leave it there for today. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com reporting for globalresearch.ca. Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com reporting for Global Research TV at globalresearch.ca. Today, I'm talking to Michelle Chossadovsky, obviously the editor of globalresearch.ca, also the founder of the Center for Research on Globalization, about his participation in the criminalization of war, specifically the Kuala Lumpur Initiative on the Criminalization of War that was first signed in 2005, so 20 years ago. Michelle Chossadovsky, thank you for your time today.
Delighted to be on the program. In many regards, this is the message also to my colleagues and friends in Kuala Lumpur, because on the 30th of this month, we are commemorating the 20th anniversary, and it is also based on the fact that Tun Mahathir Mohamad, who founded the Criminalization of War Initiative, will be honored at this meeting, so that in many regards, We are doing a certain retrospect of what has happened in the last 20 years, which in many regards is not very encouraging, because we were focusing on the criminalization of war in 2005 with a view to confronting major war initiatives. And of course, that was also the action against Israel on the one hand, and then we had the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, and then we had also, of course, action against the invasion of Iraq, Tony Blair and George W. Bush. What I have been able to assess in the course of these 20 years is that visibly today, although that was also true in 2005, there has been what we might describe as the criminalization of justice, not the criminalization. International law is there, and it can't be changed because it's based on concepts which were defined starting in 1948 with the Genocide Convention. But the issue is that the judicial system today at the global level is criminalized. And we've seen that with the International Court of Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, the two main pillars of international law. And then, of course, there are other entities which are created in relation to a specific war, like regarding, let's say, Rwanda or of course, Yugoslavia. But the question there is that the criminalization of justice is linked up to what I would describe as the criminalization of politics, in the sense that, well, in 2005 we still had honest government up to a point. We still had the welfare state in Western countries. We had movements in the global south. And what has now occurred is that if we look at the West, so-called, in other words, the United States, Canada, and the European Union, or Western Europe, there is a consensus that genocide is a legitimate undertaking. Now, when I say there's a criminalization of politics, it means that politicians are endorsing genocide against the people of Palestine. International law tells us exactly the opposite. It's Article 3E of the Genocide Convention, 1948. That any complicity in an act of genocide would be passible of punishment and a legal procedure. And that we should understand that the political apparatus is criminalized. And unfortunately, the peace movement is not confronting or is not in a position to actually confront the politicians and say, well, you are a criminal, okay? Now, that applies. It applies in Palestine, but it applies in many other instances. Genocide was also instrumented in the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, the invasion of Afghanistan was based on the fact, not on the fact, but on the illusion that Al-Qaeda had attacked America, okay? And now, I don't want to get into that, but it's pretty well established that, first of all, Al-Qaeda was created by U.S. intelligence, and Al-Qaeda in Arabic means the base, the base on the computer system of U.S. intelligence, and consequently, it was the base of all those who had been recruited. So this is the background. Now there's a lot more about that, and I think there's one element which has to be addressed is the criminalization of the financial apparatus. I'm not saying the I would make the distinction between the criminalization of the financial apparatus, the large banking institutions and so on the one hand, and then you have, of course, the global economy. I'm talking about the real economy. And the real economy is not a homogeneous, it's still a capitalist system, but You have industry, you have agriculture, you have the airlines. Now, it's not to say that the real economy is criminalized, but the financial apparatus has a holding on real economic activity precisely because it controls the debt, okay? And it can impose devastating impacts on the nation state, so that literally what we have also is that the welfare state is more or less on the way out. There are remnants of the welfare state in some of the Western countries. And if we're looking at a broader context, and this was brought to my attention in regards to the occupation of Syria. Well, first of all, what the Western military alliance, NATO, the United States have installed there is a head of state which is affiliated to Al-Qaeda. And in other words, Al-Qaeda becomes legit in regards to a nation state, which is Syria. But then there's another element. That war on Syria, and more generally on the Levant, the whole area of the Eastern Mediterranean, is a crime against civilization. And the crime against civilization is indicated by the fact that Damascus is a city which has existed for several thousand years, and Aleppo has even a longer history. In other words, the Levant is being destroyed, civilization is being destroyed, history is being destroyed, and people's minds are being destroyed because they don't understand what humanity involves. And I think the big message by Tun Mahathir is that this is a war against humanity. It's a much more extensive war than what we had contemplated 20 years ago. Now, the other element, and this should be understood, and it's part of a hegemonic project. I wouldn't necessarily call this U.S. imperialism, because U.S. imperialism, the United States is in crisis as well. But if you look at the history of empires, you can't really build an empire with a republic. I think Julius Caesar invoked that concept many years ago. But the thing is that the whole process of warfare now, from an economic standpoint, is to acquire control over, largely over, strategic resources and energy, and specifically oil and gas. And recent events in Venezuela demonstrate that, in that Venezuela today is the largest it's the largest in terms of reserves of oil and natural gas. It's number one. And consequently now, the Trump administration has created what is tantamount to a terrorism entity within Latin America. Of course, they can't use the same concepts as of Islamism and recruitment of jihadists and so on. But there, it is associated with organized crime, but the organized crime has never been controlled by Venezuela. And I know I worked in Venezuela at one time. I was there at the time when they actually were, and that was back in the 19 in the 1970s when they nationalized petroleum. It was negotiated with big oil. Obviously, that was a semi-colony of the United States. But nonetheless, the legal process was completed. But what I'm saying here is that every single country on the planet is, if they don't conform, the intervention will be through a regime change or a color revolution or whatever you want to talk, describe it. But how the intelligence apparatus of the West manages to create conditions, whether it's in regards to elections or whether it in regards to a particular head of state or head of government that they want to get rid of, that has become the norm. We've lived that virtually through the whole post-colonial, through the whole post-colonial period in different countries, but it would appear now that this is a generalized agenda. In other words, regime change incited by foreign interference and so on. Now, all of this would never have occurred had they not also, right from the beginning, but that was true also in 2005, the criminalization of the media, involving censorship, but also when I made the reference to genocide in Palestine, we are dealing with also another element with regard to the war in Ukraine, is that it's recognized and it's documented that the government in Ukraine is Nazi or neo-Nazi. And consequently, the same laws which pertain to genocide take Germany. Germany has very strict laws on cooperation with entities which are Nazi or neo-Nazi. Now, it just so happens that the German government is channeling weapons and money to a government which is overtly Nazi. Now, the media will give you another perspective. They might say they're extreme right political parties, but they will not acknowledge the fact that these are Nazis, and they are also, it's exactly the same group of Nazis which were collaborating with the Third Reich, specifically in Western Ukraine, and they are there running the government. And our laws would say you're not allowed to. Our laws in Western countries would come to the conclusion that this is something which is also object of trial and punishment and prison. Okay, now so that we have the criminalization of politics, we have the criminalization of the judicial system, both internationally and nationally. We have prime ministers like Starmer in the United Kingdom, who is supportive of genocide, in other words, killing children, so that in effect we are on the border of what we might describe as World War III, but we're probably already involved in a third world war. Now, to conclude my discussion of these issues, I should mention nuclear war. Now, the history of nuclear war is misunderstood. It is characterized by the so-called Manhattan Project, which was led by Oppenheimer. There's a lot of propaganda around that. But one thing which nobody knows, even though it is, well, people do know it because the declassified documents are there, is that the United States of America, on the 15th of September 1945, just about a month, a bit more than a month after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, released, it was the War Department, now they call it the Pentagon, the War Department issued a plan to bomb the Soviet Union, 66 cities with 200 atomic bombs. And that has always been, it has never been mentioned. The documents are there. The media does not cover it. In a sense, what was initiated with the Manhattan Project is the development of a weapon which ultimately can destroy humanity in its entirety. And that is what we have to address. And we have to demilitarize. But I should mention that Obama, when he started his presidency, but it was his second mandate, he put together, and this is the biggest lie in American history. He initiated a campaign. He said, we must ensure that the terrorists, namely Al-Qaeda, should not get hold of nuclear weapons because that would threaten our security. And he had a big campaign internationally on the fact that the real threat came from Al-Qaeda, the base, the computer, the people that we recruited. And they, if they have possession of nuclear weapons, they're going to destroy us. Now, there's a whole element of ridicule on that because nuclear weapons, you need a delivery system, you need scientists and so on. And obviously, Osama bin Laden didn't have those facilities. But what he did justify was a budget of $1 trillion for assigned specifically to nuclear weapons. $1 trillion. That, and he got the Nobel Prize. He got the Nobel Prize for doing that. Okay? $1 trillion. Now you can imagine how many schools and hospitals you can build with $1 trillion. But that $1 trillion now goes up to $2 trillion in 2030. It is currently at 1.3, and it is not regulated by the federal government's audits and expenditures. In other words, it's not really part of the budget, which is subjected to review by the Senate and the House of Representatives and so on. So bear in mind, they have increased the budget on nuclear weapons technology from $1 trillion to $2 trillion, and at the same time they claim that this will enable peacemaking bombs. They actually say that the use of nuclear weapons is preemptive. It's there to protect yourself. Now, all of this is rubbish from the scientific point of view, from the strategic point of view, but it is exceedingly dangerous when you have politicians like Donald Trump, who hasn't the foggiest idea of the impacts of nuclear war. And he said, well, if it's safe for civilians, because the explosion is underground and we're using certain types of bombs, then let's go ahead and use them. And actually, many of these smaller tactical nuclear weapons have been declassified and are now within the conventional war theater, so that a three-star general, legally a three-star general, can go ahead and use it. Now, all of this is documented, and I think what we have to do, we have to continue with the initiative which was launched by Tun Mahathir Mohamad in 2005, and it's very important that this initiative also extends and leads to dialogue within the peace movements, and we have to apply international law against those who violate. The judicial system is criminalized. We have to decriminalize the judicial system. In other words, if our leaders are in favor of genocide, they go to prison. That is what a real legal system involves. But we notice that exactly the opposite is occurring, because they've turned it upside down, and they say killing the Palestinians is a mean to achieve peace in the Middle East.
You have covered a lot of ground there, Professor. Thank you very much for that. In wrapping up, do you have any message for Dr. Tun Mahathir Mohamad or the other attendees here at the conference in Kuala Lumpur?
Well, I have a message of solidarity, and I recall very precisely how this dialogue emerged, and how Tun Mahathir chaired our sessions, and I understand his tremendous political insight, that every single person in that meeting said something, and then at the end, Mahathir actually then integrated this into a series of concepts which ultimately led to the formulation, and then it led to the tribunal and so on. But there were several hiccups, but in substance, I think we achieved something which was unique, which went against the stream. And I think it is absolutely essential that we continue, despite the impediments this very powerful initiative of Tun Mahathir Mohamad, who has recently celebrated his 100th year anniversary. I think we have to emphasize that we are committed to humanity, and we are committed to life, and we're committed to civilization, and we must recognize that humanity is a tremendous it has civilizations, and all those civilizations have something in common, and that is the value of humanity itself. So that would be my concluding notes. And unfortunately, I've not been able to travel to Kuala Lumpur to be with my friends and colleagues at this important commemoration.
Some very profound and sober words for reflection. Thank you very much for sharing them with us. Professor Chossadovsky, thank you for your time.